and gentlemen.
Can I please have your attention?
Can you dig it?
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by The Dispatch and thedispatch.com. Come to thedispatch.com to sign up for our free stuff, as well as become a paid member of the community and possibly find out what the Shanshu prophecy really says. Today's episode is brought to us by our friends at Donors Trust. More about them in a little bit. So today we have a treat. We have an old friend of mine, the guy who was our sort of ringer coach when Peter Rodman and I went off to Oxford about 15 years ago to debate at the Oxford Political Union, and it was of immense help. And he was also sort of a former colleague or comrade in arms of mine in my NR days. And he's come out with a new book that I highly recommend, The Socialist Temptation. And his name is Ian Murray. Ian, welcome to the Remnant Podcast. It's a shame we haven't had you on sooner.
Well, it's a delight to be here. That's something else crossed off my bucket list.
And speaking of bucket list, just so listeners, I think everyone knows at this point that we do these things. We're doing these things by Zoom and Zencaster and this kind of stuff. And so, because we don't go into the studio, which I miss. So we see each other when we're doing this over the interwebs, but this is the first time when we've had a guest whose background for the Zoom meeting was the interior of a TARDIS from Doctor Who. It's very impressive. And when I first saw you, I was just like, oh my God, is that actually his basement? Because that is nerdery of the next level. But I assume you paid for this set. This is just a digital backdrop, right? This is not actually your TARDIS.
Well, yes. Thanks to the BBC's generosity, they have they've donated a huge number of Zoom backgrounds, which you can find somewhere on the BBC website. But I do have a friend who actually did build not just a TARDIS platform, but a Dalek in his basement. So he has both sides covered.
Wow, that's very cool. I kind of always wanted to get. I remember I was never a huge Doctor Who guy, but I remember watching it when I was a kid, and I remember the K-9 robot, which was their sort of fake dog. I always kind of wanted to get myself one of those. All right, so let's sort of dive right in. I've been going through the book. Full disclosure, I haven't finished it yet. It was waiting for me when I got back from my adventures out west, and I've just been digging out. But fortunately, it's eminently readable, and so you can sort of dance around looking up stuff. And it's also, I think, it's very useful as an introduction to just the whole idea of socialism, because it gets so confusing and so terminologically weedy so quickly. So why don't we just sort of start there? How would you define socialism? And maybe we'll run through some of the other sort of variants of it as well.
Well, that's the multi-trillion dollar question now, of course. What is socialism? And you know, how I define it may well be different from how the Democratic Socialists of America, how AOC, how Bernie Sanders define it. I would define socialism as popular control of the means of production, distribution, and exchange. That's, in many ways, the classic formulation. However, these days, when you ask Democratic Socialists what they mean by socialism, or ask young people who are attracted to socialism what they mean by socialism, they generally mean something like a very, very large welfare state. At least that's what they say they mean. But then when you look at the policies that that people like AOC and Bernie Sanders are pushing, it's very much the traditional socialism of popular control, either by ownership or by very tight regulation of the means of production, distribution, and exchange. So there's a certain rhetorical slipperiness going on there, even when it comes to the definition of socialism.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think we should clarify some of this stuff. I mean, there is a difference between communism. I mean, maybe not in the bedrock assumptions, maybe not in some economic fallacies that they all derive from, but it just is a matter of conversational common sense. there's a difference between communism, socialism, social democracy, market socialism, even state capitalism, and all these kinds of things. They insist that they're for social democracy, right? So why don't you yeah. sort of explain what that is?
Well, you know, the original socialism of Marx and Engels was revolutionary socialism, and you know the idea was that the only way you could assert this popular control was through revolution, and that revolution was inevitable. You know, it was cast very much in the language of a violent class struggle. Then there became democratic socialism, the idea that, well, you don't have to have a revolution. You can actually just achieve socialism through success at the ballot box. And that's what happened in most of Western Europe in the after the Second World War. But then a lot of people realized in Western Europe that perhaps having this ridiculously tight control over and public ownership over every aspect of the economy was actually leading to people getting poorer, when what they wanted to do was make people wealthier. So there was a sort of shift in a lot of Europe towards social democracy, whereby you have this large welfare state paid for by a free market capitalist base with quite high tax rates. So that's where most of Western Europe ended up as a social democracy. Then there are other variants. You know, you mentioned state capitalism, you know, which is essentially what China's turned into, where the state has a compelling interest in all the private industry. That's actually not too far off from where fascism was, where the state actually organized the cartels and destroyed small business but promoted large business. It's really pretty similar to where we are with China at the moment. So I think those are the four main forms of socialism that we see around the world today.
Yeah, you sort of alluded to an important distinction that I think is lost in a lot of people. It seems to me that there are probably plenty of reasons. Actually, I have theories about why people are attracted to socialism that I think you at least have some sympathy for, but two of the primary motivating passions for why people get attracted to socialism are concern with equality or concern with poverty. And it seems to me that one of the reasons why it's flipped to equality for the large part is because capitalism has actually won the argument about poverty. And so now the problem isn't that you actually have objectively, truly poor, extreme poor people, not counting homeless people in the United States. You have subjectively poor people. You have poor people that, measured against how rich everyone else is, are, despairingly poor. And so the idea of income inequality becomes more important, because that chasm between the haves and the have-nots, though on a sliding scale. I mean, like, my point is, there are poor people in this country who qualify as poor and that we should be concerned about their poverty, who still have more material resources than some villages in India, right? And so it has less to do with the ability to feed yourself or find shelter for yourself, and more to do with the fact that there seems to be this undemocratic small d divergence in wealth and status. And so many of the people who talk about socialism these days, it's really fascinating once you start listening for it. They talk less about bringing people up and more about tearing people down, right? They want to make the billionaires poorer, but very rarely do they actually talk about making the poor people richer.
Well, that was exactly the point that Margaret Thatcher made in her farewell speech in the House of Commons back in 1990, that the Labour Party was all about it didn't matter to the Labour Party if people were at the lowest end had been raised up, if the people on the higher end had also raised up. They were more concerned with tearing down that top end than they were at the bottom end. So this idea has a long pedigree. One of the things that my colleague Ryan Young and I pointed out in a couple of studies in around 2015, when Thomas Piketty was just made his huge splash, is that the big question missing from the inequality debate is how are the poor actually doing? You never hear this. Right. And the answer to that is because, as you say, the poor have been doing exceptionally well, not just in America, but around the world, you know, compared to the historical performance. You know, there's a good argument that most people in America are richer when you take everything into account than John D. Rockefeller was. Mm-hmm. And that's an astonishing change.
Yeah, no, I think the median income in the United States puts something like the vast majority of Americans are in the global 1%. In terms of something like that, right? You know, and it's like if you believe in the logic of the 1% and you don't believe in borders, right? And you believe in universal humanity and all that, then why shouldn't the rest of the world tear down our 1%? You know, I mean, there are all sorts of logical slippery slopes in a lot of this kind of stuff. But let's get back. So what is the socialist temptation, and why is it so tempting?
Well, my argument is based on something that I learned at the feet of the great Fred Smith, who was the founder of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And he always pointed out that underneath our politics are values. And it's those values which in many ways are determined by our attitudes to risk. It's those values that are fundamental to politics. Socialism has done a very good job of talking at that level of values. There are three fundamental values, really, in American politics, according to the field of cultural cognition that Fred ascribed to. The one is the egalitarians. We've already talked a little bit about them. You know, for them, fairness is the most fundamental value. Then there are the libertarians, for want of a better word, for whom freedom is the most fundamental value. And socialism talks a good game when it comes to freedom. They say you don't have freedom unless you have agency. And you can only have agency if the state provides you with the wherewithal to have that agency. And indeed, you know, go back to the Communist Manifesto. It said, workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains.
Right.
Socialism talks the language of freedom, which I think we often forget. And finally, socialism also talks the value of community. So, in fact, you know, the word socialism derives from the Latin word for ally. You know, so socialism is all about getting people together to pool resources for the benefit of the community. And indeed, socialists, democratic socialists, often talk about how wonderful it was. They have a sort of a conservatism about them when they talk about how wonderful it was in the 1950s when there were very high tax rates and union jobs meant that most people had a career for life. That really helped the community, and we've seen capitalism tear that down. So socialism speaks a very good job of when it talks of that value as well. Meanwhile, those of us who support the free enterprise system, we tend to talk about history and about economics and about aggregate GDP and all sorts of things, and we're not talking at that values level. And I think that's what's allowed socialism to slip back into the conversation. Socialism talks about values, which allows people to say, oh, well, America's not perfect. We need solutions. And socialism says, here are some easy solutions that speak to your values.
I think this is a hugely important point. And I want to get sort of do a deeper dive on this, because one of the things I have the hardest time explaining to fellow conservatives, particularly of a cranky libertarianish bent of a certain age, is that they'll tell me something I already know, something you already know, you've written at book length about, that socialism doesn't work as an economic theory. I completely agree. It doesn't. Depending on what, again, what you mean by socialism. But what they don't get is that for a lot of people, socialism is not primarily an economic theory. It is this weird bundle of values and preconceptions about everyone being in it together. And this is one of the reasons why it's sort of a running joke among champions of socialism to say they can't define it. And so I want to, and I don't mean to trigger you by quoting both Sidney Webb and Tony Blair, but I think it's worth sort of to illustrate the point. And as you know, the British Labour Party used to have this thing called Clause 4. And as part of the British Liberal Party's constitution, and it read in part, to secure for the workers by hand or by brain the full fruits of their industry and the most equitable distribution thereof that may be possible upon the basis of the common ownership of the means of production, distribution, and exchange, and the best obtainable system of popular administration and control of each industry or service. And then in 1995, at the urging of Tony Blair after a very bitter struggle, the Labour Party rewrote it to say, the Labour Party is a democratic socialist party. It believes that by the strength of our common endeavor, we can achieve more than we achieve alone, so as to create for each of us the means to realize our true potential, and for all of us as a community in which power, wealth, and opportunity are in the hands of the many, not the few. And Blair explained this switch at the party convention by saying, socialism for me was never about nationalization or the power of the state, not just about economics or even politics. It is a moral purpose to life, a set of values, a belief in society, in cooperation, in achieving together what we cannot achieve alone. It is how I try to live my life, how you try to live yours. The simple truths: I am worth no more than anyone else. I am my brother's keeper. I will not walk by on the other side. We are not simply people in isolation from one another, face to face with eternity, but members of the same family, same community, same human race. This is my socialism, and the irony of all our long years in opposition is that those values are shared by the vast majority of the British people. He then went on to say that while he doesn't believe in socialism, he believes in social-ism. The reason why I bring it up is I think it's really that Blair, for all our criticisms of him, captured something that I think was essentially right, is that socialism appeals to people almost primarily as, particularly in this day and age, not capitalism. Like, if this is capitalism, I don't like it. I want something else where I feel more valued and part of something larger. And to me, that's the real temptation and why it's never going to go away, is because socialism, you can gussy it up with all sorts of economic stuff. It's really this sort of tribal desire for communitarianism, for belonging, for, you know, if we all work our hardest and try our best, we can make this the best yearbook ever, right? I mean, it's that kind of feeling that they want. And you get into some of that in the book. But anyway, what did you think of the Blair stuff at the time? And do you think he was basically right?
Two things. The first is, you know, I'd forgotten that speech, but you're very right to draw attention to it. The thing that always struck me about that speech was how Christian it was. Mm-hmm. In a way that no leader of the Labour Party in Britain since, certainly not Jeremy Corbyn, or indeed for that matter the Democratic Socialists of America, that they wouldn't use language like the Good Samaritan. Right. So I think, you know, already that era has gone. But the most important thing about I think about it was that the way Blair's government actually behaved was, yes, they had rejected common ownership, and they even moved to start privatizing the Royal Mail, the British equivalent of the U.S. Postal Service in 2008, before Blair stepped down, I think. they rejected common ownership, but they replaced that with a model of very tight bureaucratic control over the economy. Mm-hmm. So, and the great genius of that was that if something went wrong owing to regulation, they could claim that it was the industry's fault. They should have done better. Whereas under the old system, when your train didn't arrive in the morning, you blamed the Minister of Transport.
Right.
Now you blamed the private services whose services were crippled by fare regulation and so on. So Blair's government, while it had theoretically moved on from the Socialist Party of the past, actually behaved in a lot of ways very like just a more sophisticated Wilsonian party from the 60s.
And you mean Wilsonian, British Wilsonian, not...
Yes, sorry, Harold Wilson, yes, the man with the pipe.
Yes. Yep. The other Wilson is, is a problematic figure in history and in on this podcast. So,
the same
So what do you do about the fact if, as I mentioned before, that, you know, particularly among young people, the appeal of socialism doesn't derive from a close study of the labor theory of value or anything like that, but rather is this sort of more mushy-headed, and I don't mean that necessarily as pejoratively as it sounds, but sort of communitarian, plus a certain amount of just exerting their own naked economic self-interest, which they think they can better achieve through an increased welfare state. How do you combat that? How do you persuade young people that, you know, that while their values are not necessarily wrong, they're just not thinking through how they're applying them or how they want to fulfill them?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think one of the things we can do is actually take a leaf out of the Marxist books, the Marxist own book, which is, they often used to talk about heighten the contradictions of capitalism. The thing about socialism is that it's full of contradictions. And I outline a lot of these in my book. And, you know, for example, democratic socialists claim to be about democracy. That's their number one principle. All we're talking about is the extension of democracy. How can you complain about the people having oversight over the economy? Yeah. Okay, let's take that as read. Then why is it that socialism always devolves into bureaucracy? It's quite simple, because the people cannot possibly oversee every aspect of the economy. So there has to be a delegation of power to a new class of people who are acting on behalf of the people at large. That class, whether you call them bureaucrats, apparatchiks, commissars, they always start to behave like a new ruling class. This is the great allegory of Animal Farm. The pigs take on that duty for the animals, and end up walking on their hind legs and changing the slogan from "all animals are equal" to "all animals are equal," to "some are more equal than others." Democratic socialism always collapses at best into bureaucracy and at worst into an administrative tyranny, and so that's the sort of contradiction that you can draw to the attention of somebody who is tempted by socialism. It's a process of thinking through what the rhetoric actually means.
So let's talk about that for a second, because you mentioned Fred Smith earlier, and he's actually the guy who I heard talk about Joseph Schumpeter's capitalism, socialism, democracy, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago, and set me on this little cheese hunt through an intellectual maze about all of it. And he is the one who first pointed out to me that Schumpeter predicted the demise of capitalism because of this very phenomenon that you're talking about, which I actually write a lot about in my most recent book, this rise of the new class, which is, Schumpeter, I mean, I talk about this a lot on the podcast, so I don't want to repeat all of it, but Schumpeter has this mode of analysis that he borrows from Nietzsche about how through sort of culture war resentment, the children of the wealthy, essentially, the children of the bourgeois, use the one tool that they have at their hands, which is communication, words, images, all the rest, to redefine what is good and what is evil in ways that redound to their own benefit. And lots of people have used this process of, or this argument about the new class, lots of people on our side of the ledger. If you've never read it, Josh Moravchik, I'm trying to see what the date is, and I printed out right before we came in here. 1981, wrote this wonderful piece for the World Affairs Institute, Theories of the New Class, where it's just basically like a field guide to all of the different theoreticians of new class analysis. And there are a lot of different schools of it, but the basic gist is what you're talking about, is that basically you create, in effect, a secular aristocracy of planners, of intellectuals who take what was great about liberal democratic capitalism and redefine it as evil. The 1619 Project does this. I mean, the cultural Marxists do this. The Hollywood does this. This is not like hard to find examples of it. But Schumpeter basically predicts that it is inevitable. It's an inevitable problem that will come with capitalism as it throws off more and more intellectuals than it can absorb. And those intellectuals then start to game the system for their own benefit. And so while I agree with you that socialism always creates apparatchiks and a new class, there's an argument that all systems do, including capitalism. What do you say about that? Do you agree with that? What do you do about it?
Well, I think this is where I'm going to resort to quoting my old mate Dan Hannan, who believes that the great thing about capitalism is that the innovators are always one or two steps ahead of the new class, the regulators, who will try and try to stop them. So I think that capitalism does have an inbuilt escape valve as long as you allow innovation. Innovation will disintermediate some of the bureaucrats, will make the children of the of the wealthy who have turned to another way, their pet projects will dissipate thanks to innovation. The question is, can that class, that new class, just close off the engine of innovation? And I worry that we are beginning to. It may be that, if you look at the figures for dynamism and so on, the creation of new firms, it may be that's beginning to escape valve is beginning to be shut off. Mm-hmm. One thing I'm extremely worried about, and this is something we see that we come from the right as coming from the right as well, is that antitrust enforcement may, in an effort to promote smaller firms, may actually and innovative firms may actually cut off that valve as well. Clayton Christensen, the late Harvard professor, talked about the innovator's dilemma, which is that if you're in R&D at a big firm, you know that your the norms and beliefs and corporate the culture that you have will stop a certain amount of innovation happening. So you look outside the firm, and then you find a source of innovation outside the firm, and you buy it. And this is how Facebook and the other big tech giants have performed for the last decade or so. But when you look at it, now that seems as if it's a bad thing. But when you look at it from the entrepreneur's point of view, what do you do with your great idea? Do you build it? Try to build it up to become the next Facebook? Well, that involves things like going through the IPO process, going through horrible financial regulation. You have to deal with a huge amount of administrative law. Or do you just get it to a certain size, then sell out and move on to the next thing? What we might be saying with the new hipster antitrust and its equivalent on the right is saying, no, that process can't happen anymore. That's going to dissuade a huge amount of innovation. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an example of what's happening at the moment, that we are seeking out sources of innovation and trying to crush them out. And if that happens, then Dan will be proved wrong, and the innovators will be only one step ahead of the regulators, and that means they'll probably get caught.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Dan, and he's a friend of this podcast and all that. I would phrase it sort of slightly differently, because I don't think it's true that the innovators are always one or two steps ahead. I think that enough innovators are a couple steps ahead, because I think both of us could sit here, and you in particular, since you're a CEI guy, and list all sorts of examples of innovators who weren't a couple steps ahead and got rolled over by crushing regulatory stuff. It's just that...
Absolutely,
not to use a self-promotional phrase here, but it's almost as if there's just enough of a remnant of the innovators who make it, who then get to plant the seeds. But Lord knows what innovation this is a very Peter Thiel point, right? Is that the innovators, the regulators really have done a lot of bad things about curtailing innovation with physical stuff, but they and with medical stuff, but they were too slow to catch up on the digital stuff, which is now why we have this famous disequilibrium where we have lots of apps but not many jetpacks, right? And I don't want a lot of regulatory crackdown. I'm not one of these paranoid guys about Section 230 and all that kind of stuff. But I could live with a little less innovation on the digital side for a little while if the price were, in some sort of weird bargain, more innovation on the medical side and on the physical side and on the energy side, where I think we've been much slower, right? I mean, but anyway, that's a digression. You're free to respond to. I just wanted to get that out there. All right, so I'm going to pick a fight with you now. And you're probably the wrong person to pick the fight with, but that's your bad luck. In fact, you may not even want to fight me on this. But given your definition or your argument about what is tempting about socialism, how we both agree that it's not primarily an economic theory. I mean, one of my favorite lines is from, on the subject of defining socialism, when Irving Howe and Lewis Kozer, who were the editors of the Socialist Journal of Dissent, were asked to come up with a definition of socialism in 1954, all they could come up with was, socialism is the name of our desire. but be that as may, the real question is, given that it's largely a communitarian thing, it's about social solidarity, the economics is in some ways an afterthought, tell me, as a matter of first principles, what the real difference is between nationalism and socialism. Because generations of Marxists and quasi-Marxists and pseudo-Marxists and ersatz Marxists have been arguing that these things are opposites. And if you're looking at international socialism versus nationalism, you can make that argument, but there hasn't been an example of a living, breathing, successful international socialist movement for a century. All successful socialist movements, such as it were, have always been nationalistic. So what is the first order difference between socialism and nationalism?
Well, I think the only difference is that nationalism doesn't have to be socialist, but I think socialism is always nationalist. Yeah, this is one of the things I try to point out in the book, is that for all the talk about the International Brotherhood of Man, socialism has always been hostile to the principle of emigration. They like immigration, but they really don't like emigration. You know, so in the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels say that any emigre must have all his property confiscated. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right there in the foundational document. But of course, when we look at actual socialist states in actual operation, they realize that that wasn't enough. That when people leave, they don't just take their physical capital with them; they take their human capital with them. That capital is a brain, a pair of hands that can be used to better the state. So therefore, we got to the stage of the Berlin Wall and people being shot inches from the West German border because they could not be allowed to leave. You know, the whole principle of defection and dissidence and the rest. That's all, I think, inherent to socialism. Yes, the state may grow and the state may become an empire, but it's still a socialist empire, but it's still nationalist at heart. I don't think there's any way of getting around that.
So it's an interesting distinction, because I've had this argument a lot that all socialisms are nationalist, but not all nationalisms are socialist. I got to think about that a little bit. At first blush, I think part of my, I don't know if it's a disagreement, but it's a bone of contention that comes to mind, is that the problem with that formulation, if there is one, because I still kind of like it, is that there is no limiting principle to the concept of nationalism let me put it this way. When you embrace the logic of nationalism, which has no, which basically says the collective will, the people, the folk, the fatherland, however you want to describe it, is the bedrock moral good of the society. It is the fundament, right? Then there is no principled argument against socialism, right? Because at the end of the day, the central government is the only institution, and particularly the president, but is the only institution in the entire country that can claim to legitimately speak for the entire country. And so therefore there is no legitimate bulwark against the federal government doing whatever it wants in the name of nationalism and the national will. And so I don't know that it's obvious to me. I'm trying to think of, have there been nationalist governments? Well, I guess Pinochet, right? I mean, I guess there have been nationalist governments where they have moved towards democracy and capitalism rather than away from it. But gosh, I guess they're few and far between, right?
Yeah, I think it is possible to be a national liberal. Uh-huh. I think essentially Britain in the 19th century was a national liberal polity. Mm-hmm. The movement of reforms essentially the triumph of the Liberal Party mm-hmm. in the middle of the 19th century was very much tied to nationalism. The probably the greatest nationalist prime minister of Britain was Lord Palmerston, who was a liberal.
Yeah.
And I think it is possible. I think it's difficult. One other thing that is that during that same time period is that liberalism embraced nationalism in the breakup of empires. Mm-hmm. Around Europe, so nationalism and liberalism have actually been tied together at some point. Whether it's going to be possible these days is another question. I had hoped that the Brexit would produce a sort of initially nationalist liberal Britain that would then realize that it needed to get together with its colleagues in the Anglosphere. I don't think that is actually what's happening at the moment. I think mm-hmm. if you look at the policies that Boris Johnson's government's pursuing, they turned away from free markets almost as much as well more so I think than parts of the administration here. So I'm not sure whether it's possible under the current circumstances to be a nationalist liberal, but
yeah, no, that's
I think it has
point.
Been in the past.
Yeah, no, I think it seems to me that maybe one way in which it is possible or was possible in the past is when there was a large amount of there's a national consensus about what it means to be a member of the nationality, right? I mean, like yeah. And part of the problem, not to invoke Daniel Hannan again, but is that I'm sorry, the Brits are just weird, right? And yes. I mean, as a historical matter, they're weird, and he gets into
absolutely.
It. He's got a great Whiggish history of their weirdness. I mean, he doesn't call them weird, but they're
yep.
weird, And if
liberal unusual, has,
yeah, well, yeah. I mean, like if liberal democratic capitalism were the natural way for social formation, we wouldn't have waited until basically. The late 1600s, early 1700s, for it to happen on this one island backwater. Again, no offense, but there was just this weird confluence of events, partly to do with regime change from Holland, that made it possible. And so the fact that the Brits could manage to square these circles in ways, and then for a while Americans too. Shouldn't be that surprising, but there is now in America, as you know, I mean, there's very little consensus about what it means to be an American.
Yep.
And in fact, there's a lot of animosity towards the idea of creating Americans. Assimilation is now a bad word. And I think that one of the reasons why socialism is more popular is it is a way to create a new definition of social solidarity that isn't based upon any of our history or our cultures or traditional notions of patriotism. Instead, it's these abstract social justice theories that people can claim loyalty to that really have nothing to do with being an American. They have to do with, being a green consumer and driving, a Subaru that runs on recycled, cooking oil or something.
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, I think On weirdness, I think in Britain we would say I'm unusual, you're eccentric, he's weird. But I think that weirdness, that eccentricity, if you will, was actually tied in very closely to a set of institutions and customs that had grown up during the Middle Ages and through the Tudor period and the Reformation and the war of religion in the mid 17th century. So it was a very distinct set of institutions and customs. But we needed those institutions and customs to be a national liberal polity. Mm-hmm. I think you're very right to point out that modern socialism is all about destroying institutions and customs. So if you take away that basis, we'll never have the right set of circumstances for a national liberal national liberal polity again.
So I mean, since you bring up the importance of institutions and their crucial role in sort of shaping sort of political economy in a healthy direction and keeping a sense of cultural identity alive, I think it's really important to talk about donors' trust. Giving USA recently reported that Americans increased their charitable giving last year. Are you among the millions of Americans wanting to grow your charitable impact, but recognize that your time is limited? With a donor-advised fund at Donors Trust, you spend less time on administration and more time having an impact for your principles and values. A donor-advised fund is like your own charitable savings account. With a fund, you can manage your charitable giving in a way that's smart, tax-advantaged, and private. Donors Trust is unique, working with donors at all levels who share a commitment to the freedoms and principles that make America great. Donors Trust philanthropic advisors can help you sharpen your giving, discover new groups, and define your charitable legacy. Join their community of liberty-minded donors at Donors Trust to see how a donor-advised fund could benefit your giving. Go to donorstrust.org/dingo for their 6 reasons to use a donor-advised fund. That's DonorsTrust, DonorsTrust.org/dingo to sign up and to check out their 6 reasons to use a donor-advised fund. We thank Donors Trust for sponsoring today's episode of The Remnant. So, all right, since I utterly failed to pick a fight with you on the first thing, and instead you left me having to rethink some of my position, for which I will punish you later, I want to try something else on
you. I look forward to it.
So, as you know, I wrote this book called Liberal Fascism, right? And you mentioned fascist economics as state capitalism earlier. I think that's right. I certainly think a lot of academics would agree with you that what they had was state capitalism. I think there are also a lot of students of Nazi Germany in particular, but also, I guess, Mussolini, fascist Italy, not Spain, which is just a different thing. And there are a lot of people who don't even think it was fascist. That the internal logic of the ideology of Nazism and of Italian fascism would eventually, left to its own devices, inexorably led to something that looks a lot more like, you know, Venezuelan economics than Singapore economics or the state capitalism we see in China. But even if that's not the case, there's a school of thought out there that actually there's this guy, Howard Wiarda, who wrote, I'm going to butcher the name of it, but he calls it, it was something like corporatism, the third great ism. And his basic argument is that a lot of the stuff that we call both capitalism and socialism in any mixed economy is really some variant of corporatism. And I don't want to butcher the nuances of his argument, but that was sort of my takeaway from it. And I think there's a lot of truth there, right? I mean, you look at so corporatism, for listeners who don't know, is not rule by corporations. It is, which is what RFK Jr. always says. It is this this 19th century Catholic social thought school of economics that wants to find a middle way between capitalism and socialism, or capitalism and communism, that basically has all the stakeholders around the table and all the big players, unions, religious institutions, educational institutions, business institutions, the whole scope of like the and political institutions all sitting around the table making the decisions for all the little people. And it seems to me that like a big part of your day job is to fight corporatism, not socialism, and all of that. First of all, do you see it? I mean, what is this distinction in your mind between corporatism and socialism? And why is it so difficult for people, including on the right, to talk about corporatism, which in some ways is a much bigger or more present threat to capitalism than socialism is, because we have corporatism right now. We have the big players sort of gaming the system right now. And socialism is sort of the far enemy in some ways. Anyway, what do you think of all that?
Yeah, I think this is an extremely important point. One of the things that I point out in the socialist temptation is that America has had two waves of socialism light in the progressive era and the New Deal. And both of those established corporatism, one to a greater extent than the other. You know, the progressive era gave us the alphabet soup of agencies and the idea that you as a business owner are not responsible only to your consumer, but you are also responsible to some bureaucratic oversight. Then we had the New Deal. Those agencies multiplied. We had the National Labor Relations Act saying that that you are also responsible to your employee, and the government's going to look at that very with a sort of level of strict scrutiny about how you are dealing with your workers. So corporatism got established in those two in those two eras, but nevertheless, businesses were still, generally speaking, strongly pro-capitalist. As late as Ronald Reagan's time. One thing that I think we've seen over the last couple of decades is through the massive growth of regulation that my colleague Wayne Cruz documents every year in his annual snapshot of the regulatory state called 10,000 Commandments, which I commend to everyone, is a process of getting those so-called stakeholders into the corporation more and more and more. So in the end, you have the corporations who are much more concerned about what the stakeholders are saying than what the consumer is saying, which has led to the point where now we're seeing corporations actively insulting a large proportion of their consumer base. I point out in the books that businesses relate to values just as politicians do. So, when you see a large American flag on the highway from an auto dealer, then that auto dealer is talking to Americans who value tradition and the American way of life. So they're communicating at a values level. What we see now is that, especially with the phenomenon of woke corporations, those are talking the value of equality to their consumers, but are at the same time actively insulting their consumers who believe in community and tradition and the like. This may be a commercial decision, in which case, all power to them. I generally don't think that insulting half your customer base is a good business idea, but they might be able to make it work. But the signaling is not just to the customer; it's also to the stakeholders who have taken such a dominant position in American corporate life. So you've now got to the stage where one of the great bulwarks of socialism, one of the great bulwarks against socialism, American private industry has been, not totally suborned, has been subverted to a large extent.
Yeah, no, it's kind of fascinating. I don't think I'm speaking too far out of school. I mean, the events are supposed to be off the record and all that. But I don't know, about 10 years ago, I went to my first Koch Brothers, that big giant donor conference thing. And one of the most striking things to me was how, while there were clearly a lot of rich people there, and I was not one of them, I brought down the average income considerably. Very, very few heads of publicly held Fortune 500 companies, right? And that's one of the weird thing. I think the left does not grasp this at all, that, or maybe those really smart ones understand it better than both of us, but the average liberal thinks, oh, just big business is right wing, which has always been one of my big peeves. It was one of the reasons I originally wanted to write liberal fascism, was this myth that that big business was right wing. And I would push back on you a little bit about the idea that it's a bulwark for capitalism. Some big business, yes. Some big business, no. You know, U.S. Steel lobbied the government for socialization of the steel industry in what, like 1912?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But the real champions of free enterprise, first of all, are small and mid-sized businesses, which are privately owned, and the few big, can't call them, I guess you could still call them corporate, but the big corporate behemoths that aren't publicly held, right? I mean, so that's one of the reasons the Koch brothers can get away with everything that they do, like them or hate them. That's not my point. It's just simply that they own their own company. And when you are answerable to shareholders, you're also answerable to all of the sort of new class trial lawyers, social justice campaigns, all the rest. And that tends to make those big publicly held companies either risk averse or cowardly, but almost never brave about, you know, fighting for their own interests in terms of capitalism and free markets. Have you ever read Douglas North's stuff about violence and social orders and where modernity comes from and all of that?
No, I have not, but I should.
So I will be very clear. Brilliant guy, super smart, arguably one of the worst writers in the English language I have ever encountered.
Worse than Hayek?
By far, worse than Hayek. Like,
oh my
there's
God.
there's some Hayek, I mean, admittedly, there's some Hayek that you feel like they put it in the translation from German machine 30 seconds too short. And that if it just stayed in the microwave a little longer, you could read it fine.
Yes, but, exactly.
This is so abstruse. But violence and social orders, one of the points he makes is that, you know, he's sort of a champion of institutional economics. And one of the points he makes is that that he refers to sort of natural states. These are states that comport with human nature, that have a sort of a, they're like water finding its level. They can last a very long time as a regime. And part of his argument is that monarchies are like this, that corporatist systems are essentially like this. And there's just not a lot of evidence in about whether liberal democratic capitalism is like this. And so I guess the part of the question is if corporatism has such staying power, don't you think that that in some ways is a greater threat to the capitalist order? Because it just, first of all, it's well established in our political economy already, and second of all, it feels much more natural to a lot of people. Oh, yeah, of course, we want everyone to have a seat at the table. You know, that's how Obamacare was done, as they said. You know, they told all these people, you're either at the table or on the menu. That's how monarchs used to run things. That is as a steady state form of political economy. And yet very few conservatives really have any idea how to talk about it. Very few libertarians have any idea how to talk about it. And we do a little boilerplate about picking winners and losers and crony capitalism and all the rest. But that's more like corruption fighting than actually systemic reform. And it just seems to me that you guys at CEI, this is your bread and butter. And I'm just kind of curious what you think about it as the comparative threats between corporatism and socialism.
Well, I think that one of them is co-opting the other. I think socialism is co-opting corporatism in a way that we haven't seen in it at least since the 1930s. I think one of the important points to remember is that even large corporations don't actually have that long a shelf life. at least right. not in the dominant form that we think of them as. Just look at the Dow from 50 years ago, and I think something like half the corporations don't exist any longer. You know, Exxon has just left the Dow for the first time in 92 years. You know, Exxon's not going, really going anywhere, at least until the Green New Deal gets established. But the corporations aren't a lasting vehicle for this sort of thing unless they get institutionalized. And this is my big right. worry in the day job, that the regulation we're seeing at the moment, and the regulation that big companies are lobbying for, is there to try to destroy upstart competitors and to cement positions that were relatively fragile, say even 5 years ago. It's only a decade since. People were talking about needing to nationalize MySpace because it was so dominant. now Facebook is, I don't want to use the term about dominant because that has a specific meaning in antitrust law, but Facebook is very big. What we've seen with, for instance, the EU's GDPR regulation over there, which was meant to try and curb the supposed abuses of companies like Facebook, we've just seen them grow larger because the regulations have just killed off any innovation in amongst European digital tech at all. So the use of regulation to try to entrench a company, I think, is a big company, is very much recognized and is very much a tool of the corporatists. It's also a tool of the socialists because mm-hmm. they can use their regulation to impose more and more control over these big companies. So essentially, they become a de facto arm of the state. But also they use the advertising networks and the other networks that corporations have to spread their ideology. So I think this is why I'm so worried about that those indicators of dynamism. The companies that can come in a proper free market economy can come from nowhere and shake. These corporations are being held back by regulation, often always well-intentioned regulation, of course, but right. The regulations that dissuade people from going to IPO that I mentioned earlier, I think are a big factor in this. If we want to solve this problem, we need to look at not just at the direct regulation of these corporations, but other regulations which essentially act as you put it, the biological inhibitors that stop the growth of a new entity.
Yeah, I mean, the example I've always used, just because it seems to work on, people seem to grasp the point better than a lot, was the Americans with Disabilities Act, right? Which I think was a noble piece of legislation, certainly well-intentioned, probably worthwhile. I mean, I think definitely worthwhile. I mean, maybe not in every implementation. You can argue about the outliers and all the rest. But as a general proposition, this society, when it can, where it can, should be as open and as accessible to people who have handicaps or differently abled or whatever we're supposed to call it. And I'm in favor of that. That said, and that's why it's a good example. It's because it's a good piece of reform in many senses. If you're Coke or Pepsi, you got no problem fully implementing the Americans with Disabilities Act because it means that you're passing on a fraction of a penny of a cost per can to your customers. If you're a smaller regional soda company, and once you have 500 employees, you have to be fully ADA compliant. That means your 500th employee is going to cost you tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. And so it becomes a barrier to entry. And it's why big corporations tend to be fine with big regulations, because they freeze out the innovators that might actually be a threat to their model, and allow them with their one or two competitors to just carve up market share amongst them, and actually arguably increase their market share. And the point is here not to pass things like the Americans with Disability Act. It's just simply to understand in a very Tom Sowellian way, it's all about trade-offs, and that these things come at a cost. And one of the costs is you are going to entrench incumbents further into the system, which is why, in full disclosure, the Dispatch is part of Facebook's, you know, fact-checking program. But it did not shock me at all when Mark Zuckerberg went to Congress and said, "We're looking for regulation," because that will lock in. That has a greater chance of locking in Facebook as an incumbent. And as I don't want to use the word dominant, but the biggest player around, and it creates a too big to fail sort of dynamic. And that to me is that, I mean, whether you think it's the first step toward socialism or just the logical culmination of corporatism, either way, that's bad. Or at the very least, we should understand what's not good about it as a matter of public policy. And yet that stuff almost always just gets ignored in the debates about all of this.
Yeah, well, yes, exactly. And that's one of the reasons why CEI exists, to draw attention to this sort of thing, and to point out that many regulations have perverse consequences. I mean, the great example is the minimum wage that keeps a lot of people unemployed and on the welfare state, but at the same time has an adverse effect on employers, because they can't, they may need five people, but they can only afford three people to do the work. And on top of that, especially when we're looking at there's a very interesting statistic that medium-sized businesses spend more on regulation than large businesses or small businesses, because there's a sort of ramping up of regulation when you have your first employee, there are eight regulations you have to comply with, and so on. When you hire your second, there are some more, and so on. And even when you have very small workforces, this just ramps up very, very quickly. Until it gets to the stage where you actually have to hire somebody to do all this regulatory work for you, some sort of second office manager. And essentially what we're saying is that second office manager is working for the state. They're not working for the government. They're not working for the company. They're working for the state to ensure compliance. So it's as if you have an apparatchik, within your company. And of course, obviously, large businesses have rafts and rafts of these officers in compliance departments for whatever regulations that they have to deal with. So that when we think about these companies and these trade-offs, we also should be thinking that they have people there who they wouldn't employ otherwise, who are essentially agents of the state and making sure that businesses work according to the approved manner. And that's another way in which innovation gets shut off.
All right, so we're just about out of time, and I'm in violent agreement with you, but. Sort of circling back to the beginning. So, you've written this book about the socialist temptation. I think we basically agree that there's something about socialism that pings a certain kind of political sweet tooth, sociological sweet tooth in our brains. I have my theories, but one of the most annoying questions you can get on a book tour is, okay, so how do you fix the problem? So how do you fix the problem?
Well, I think, you know, I fundamentally think that this is a communications challenge. It's a mm-hmm. difficult communications challenge, but I think it is fundamentally a communications challenge. And one of the things I do is I quote Ronald Reagan's Hillsdale speech from the late 70s, where he essentially lays out exactly the same problems that we've been discussing. And he frames it as a communication challenge. So I think there are two aspects to this. The first is, you know, when talking to people who are attracted by socialism, we really need those of us on the free enterprise side really need to do a lot better at talking the language of values. You know, we need to be talking a lot more about how capitalism and the market exchanges are fundamental to producing a better world and a more cooperative world. I don't know if you know the work of the Ball State University professor Steve Horvitz, but he is really, really good at that. Mm-hmm. And I think we can learn a lot from the way that he talks about these things. I think the second thing is, you know, when people start moving beyond the level of values and start talking about, well, in a socialist society, we will see X, Y, and Z, that's when I think we need to get into actively debating the contradictions of socialism. You know, talk about how socialism talks about rights, but it has a very limited conception of rights. The old Rosa Luxemburg idea that you can only have a right if it is if it addresses some sort of power imbalance, I think it is something that we need to hammer on, because this is essentially, you know, the debate over free speech at the moment. You have free speech to attack a power imbalance. You do not have free speech to defend what's viewed as a power imbalance. So the contradiction between what most Americans understand as free speech and what socialists understand as free speech is made more apparent the more you dig into it. So I think those are two ways that we can address this communication challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I entirely agree. I agree that it's maybe the only remedy we have in the short term is the communications part of it, so we might as well get that part right. And I think you do a good job of working on that, and you should be commended for it. But I'm of the school that says that the attractiveness, I mean, I don't want to sound like, you know, some Frankfurt School, you know, with Max Horkheimer or something like that. But I do think a lot of these things begin in the family and in childhood. And there is a thing about how if you feel like if that communitarian itch has been sufficiently scratched in your life, you don't look for it in politics, right? If you have a hole in your soul, you really feel like you want to belong to something, you want to be part of something, and you can't find that in the normal parts of your life, you start looking elsewhere for it. It's what, you know, Nisbet called the quest for community. And I think that the eternal appeal of these isms, socialism, not corporatism, oddly, because no one thinks of it in those terms, but nationalism, socialism, communism, all these kinds of things, these communitarian things, they work on the fool's gold promise that the government can love you, that you can be part of something that will fill you up inside. And I think being part of the avant-garde of the proletariat can do that because you're part of this cadre, or being on a political campaign can do that. But the government can't do it for you. And so I think that, you know, we were talking earlier about the importance of institutions in Britain. I think if we had our institutional arrangements right, where people felt like they were part of something closer to home in their own communities and their own families, they wouldn't be looking to be part of some often just really dumb national, fake, abstract community or international community or identity politics community, which has got no zestiness to it. They would find it in their bowling league or in their softball league or in their church or their synagogue or in their neighborhood or the 4-H or whatever. But with the decline of those institutions, that hunger for belonging doesn't go away, and we try to find it in all of these isms, and it's not going to work. But I think long term, we either work on the communications part of it, but we also got to work on fixing a lot of these things closer to the ground so that people are just less hungry for this nonsense in the first place, if that makes sense.
That makes absolutely complete sense. I think that's a more medium term policy response to socialism. We have to. I talk about this towards the end of the book. You know, we have to get to a position where civil society is able to take on these responsibilities again, where you don't look to the government for something that an association can provide. Yeah, I think that we very much have to look at education reform. We very much have to look at health sector reform. But in general, you know, there's a whole bunch of regulations that stop the creation of the sort of mutual aid association that was prominent in America in the 19th and even the early 20th century. That mutual aid, I think, is probably going to be the best bulwark against Marxist socialism that we can get. But it's something that we lost quite a while ago, mm-hmm. And so it'd be the deregulatory program that we need to invest in is going to be broad and deep, and I don't see anybody promoting that sort of level of reform, but I think it is absolutely needed and could be the sparking point for the next great political entrepreneur in this country.
In other words, cheer up, for the worst is yet to come.
Mustn't grumble.
All right, well, Ian Murray, the book is The Socialist Temptation, and I highly recommend it to folks. And thanks so much for coming on. It's been, I would say it's been too long, but this is your first appearance, so I apologize for that.
Indeed, but let's make sure that it's not another 10 years, I think.
Yeah, we haven't chatted in a while, so.
Yeah.
So thanks a bunch. Thanks for coming, and we'll have you on soon enough again.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Jonah. Thank you so much.
Okay, so Ian has left the place. I meant to actually explain that reference to that story, but that I started with. Ian, I believe, went to Oxford and was a big debater at the Oxford Union. And I don't know, it was 10, 12 years ago. I can't remember exactly when. It was on the 500th. Anniversary of the Jamestown, or the 400th anniversary of the Jamestown colony founding, and they wanted to debate. The Oxford Union invited me and this wonderful man, Peter Rodman, and the third fellow whose name I'm spacing was a host of the BBC US network, and I'm embarrassed because I know it's going to come to me right after I'm done doing this. And anyway, the proposition was something along the lines of, on the 400th anniversary of the founding of Jamestown, be it resolved that America should never have been born, or something along those lines. And it was a great amount of fun to debate this thing. It was at the last minute, this notorious guy who was famous for being the last defender of both Stalin and communist North Korea as the preferred means of social organization, chickened out from the debate, and, you know, presumably because he thought he was going to lose. And it just was always kind of funny to me that, I mean, it's clearly this guy is not exactly allergic to lost causes. But anyway, Ian helped us enormously because it's a real tough sort of format. And the people we debated was one really talented young Oxford student, and then two crackpot, crazy, quasi-jihadist socialist guys, including one who was like literally a member of an organization that is ruled a terrorist organization in like 35 countries. And we won. That was the surprising thing. And might not have been able to were it not for Ian's help. So I've always been grateful for that. Anyway, I actually wrote about it for NR years ago. Maybe we can put it in the show notes. Anyway, I have very strong views about the socialism stuff because I think the right is really, really, really bad at talking about this stuff. And the number of people who claim to know, like, who talk with great confidence about how Black Lives Matter is Marxist, and I think it is Marxist in the sense that it comes from that part of the political culture that we call Marxist and all that kind of stuff. But the use of Marxist as an adjective among of people who've never read Marx to describe people who've never read Marx, it can get really kind of annoying. And there's a certain aspect, sort of like that there's that movie with Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor where like Wilder was deaf and Pryor was blind and they had to communicate with each other. And there's a certain aspect of that where you have, you know, people screaming, you know, you sort of MAGA-type screaming about socialism and Marxism and you have, and how evil it is. And then you have people who call themselves socialists and Marxists who have no idea, and neither side really has much idea of what they're talking about. And the problem with the asymmetry of it is that, you know, it's more important that the right convince the spectators that socialism is bad, and they're just doing a really bad job of it, I think. And anyway, so I do recommend Ian's book. It is very helpful in this regard. And I could nerd out on this for much longer. I wrote a big piece about socialism for Commentary in 2018, which we can put in the show notes as well. And anyway, thanks for your patience. Thanks for your support of the Dispatch. You know, by the way, if every subscriber of the of every listener to this podcast would just simply subscribe, would sign up for the Dispatch, we could more than double our paid membership rate. We could hire more people to do more cool stuff. We have really big, huge ambitions for all sorts of things. We're going really well. But if you really like this podcast and you feel like it provides some value in your life and you don't feel like visiting our advertisers and all the rest, and you want to show some solidarity, if you could sign up for the Dispatch as a paid member, that would be really wonderful. And we would really, really appreciate it. And other than that, thanks so much, and I'll see you next time.
No, you won't. This is a podcast.